Welcome to History Counts. History provides the roadmap to the future. If you want to know where you're going, you have to understand where you've been. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. Every day, millions of American children are compelled to attend schools where they sit in classrooms separated according to their age and their performance on standardized tests. Taught all day by strangers, the children follow a curriculum devised and mandated by people they never met. And their day is governed by a bell, which rings every 45 minutes. Has American schooling always been like this? Where did this system come from? Who imposed it? And most importantly, is this form of schooling the best way to help children develop to their full potential? Please join us as we examine the American system of compulsory schooling in this edition of History Counts, Dumbing Us Down. Welcome back to History Counts. In today's program, we're going to examine the history of American education. To help us explore this important subject, we're very fortunate to have as our guest the educator, author, and lecturer John Taylor Gatto. Mr. Gatto taught in New York City public schools for 30 years. He was named New York City Teacher of the Year in 1989, 1990, and 1991. And in 1991, he was also named New York State Teacher of the Year. Since leaving public school teaching, Mr. Gatto has been a tireless advocate for school reform. He's traveled over 3 million miles to lecture on the subject in all 50 states and 7 foreign countries. His books include Dumbing Us Down, The Underground History of American Education, and most recently, Weapons of Mass Instruction, A School Teacher's Journey Through the Dark World of Compulsory Schooling. Mr. Gatto is currently working on a documentary film about the nature of modern schooling entitled The Fourth Purpose. And his website is www.johntaylor.com. Well, Mr. Gatto, thanks very much for joining us today. Could you take us back in time and describe how Americans were educated in the colonial era and the early years of the American Republic?
Sure. The best reference for this would be two books, both very famous. One, the autobiography of Benjamin Franklin, and the other would be a gloriously written survey of America by a French aristocrat, Alexis de Tocqueville, called Democracy in America. They will be in every library in the United States. If you spend some time with both, you'll discover, A, that childhood hardly existed, that it existed up to the age of about 7, and after that, people were not only expected to carry their share of the load, but they were trusted to do that. So Ben Franklin, not from a wealthy family at all, from a family of, I believe, 15 kids, candlemaker as a father, was traveling back and forth to England and the continent in his early teen years. He also was working 60-hour week, and in addition to that, with his friends, putting themselves through an education at the age of about 12, that I believe Yale and Harvard would be reluctant to try to force on their own undergraduates today.
Did he have any formal schooling?
Franklin had 2 years of it. He was thrown out of both schools he attended because he was a bad boy. What that translates into is that he couldn't stand the limitation of opportunity that schooling offered. And the truth is, back in those days, very few people could. School would occupy 90 days a year, and a maximum of 2 hours in a seat. Now, it was nothing at all like what we have today, and there was quite a palette of different types of schooling available, but I would say the American ideal, regardless of the social class, was self-schooling. The idea was that you could undertake your own education, and no one would give it to you. You would take it by examining your own talents, your own weaknesses, and then used to learning the culture. It's very much like the unschoolers in the homeschooling community today. They trust their kids, and if someone listening is skeptical, let me tell you that the head of the Human Genome Project, Francis Collins, was an unschooler who studied whatever he felt like studying for as long as he felt like studying it. His mother only insisted that his other three brothers, all different ages, had to agree what the four of them would study. Other than that, she stayed out of the way. He shot through Harvard, you know, with star performance and shot to the top of the scientific world. There can't be a project in science today that's even close in terms of prestige.
So Ben Franklin's schooling in the 18th century was not atypical. A lot of people would have had his type of education.
Oh, a great many. In fact, if you read his autobiography, you'll see that whatever Franklin did, most of his friends were doing too. I mean, they would sometimes join together. One of the things they did was they figured out that if you couldn't hold an audience communicating in writing, that you were in a lot of trouble where maximum opportunity was concerned. And they came to the conclusion that having a style that would grasp a reader's attention and hold it was important. So where were they going to get a style? Well, they picked the best stylists of the day, and they created this project for themselves. I would urge somebody listening to do this with their own kid today. They would try to rewrite an essay by someone with a good style in their own words until a third party looking at it would say, oh, you must have taken this from the New Yorker, you know, or some other high-style publication. And then they would realize that they had mastered style A, style B, style C. The autobiography is full of similar suggestions. When they were learning science, they actually did real scientific experiments. Nowhere in the United States today does that happen in a school. Even in the famous science schools, what happens is you imitate an experiment that everybody knows what the result's going to be. I mean, we're training clerks in the sciences rather than scientists.
Well, this form of schooling was later eclipsed, and you traced the origin of the modern American school system to a Napoleonic battle that took place in Europe in 1806. Could you please explain?
Sure. First, I think it's important that your listeners understand that Napoleon's armies were amateur armies. Germany, northern Germany, the military state of Prussia, was quite unlike that. Everybody lifted their fork at the same time, so they were used to winning all their battles. And when Napoleon menaced Prussia, it was assumed that it would be an open-and-shut victory for Prussia. Instead, Napoleon's armies at the Battle of Jena, that's J-E-N-A, in 1806, wiped out the Prussian army. That was a lot more important than simply losing a battle, because the chief cash income of the state of Prussia was renting out soldiers to other countries, and you can't get a good price for your soldiers if they get whipped by an amateur like Napoleon. So at that moment, a national panic ensued. And a famous philosopher from the University of Berlin, Johann Fichte, that's spelled F-I-C-H-T-E, demanded publicly of the Prussian king that this never happen again. He said this happened because people thought for themselves. And he suggested, in fact, demanded a new institution of universal forced schooling where everyone would be on the page that the boss wanted them to be on. And after years and years of this kind of drill and testing, the Army would dependably follow the orders it was given. Prussia pulled it off by marching the kids to school at Bayonet Point, and as a consequence, turning lives into human resources. And a leader then can focus the human resources, confident that there'll be no contradictions. That works with a factory economy. Does not work to give the majority of people good lives, but it does work to build wealth and to give great wealth to the leadership, the management.
So the education is oriented towards the interest of the state, not towards the interest of the individual student.
The state, and also the interests of the dominant economy, making it more efficient. When Prussian schooling came to the United States big time, it was brought here by Andrew Carnegie, John D. Rockefeller, Vincent Astor, Harriman. I mean, they front some poor chump named Horace Mann, who loved the Prussians, just loved them. But in fact, Mann was a politician who had no interest whatsoever in children or schooling. He was promised a seat in the American Congress if he could pull off forced schooling, and he did, and he got his seat in Congress.
Well, now, Horace Mann was a Massachusetts politician and lawyer. He was patronized by these industrialists. Did they send him to Prussia?
They sent him to Prussia. He dawdled on the way over, and when he got there, the schools were closed. So he was now faced with the prospect of returning to his backers in Massachusetts saying, sorry, I goofed up. No, he didn't do that. He came back and he said that what he had seen was paradise on earth. It was a utopia. You can read what he said in his seventh letter to the Boston school community. And he says, we must have Prussian schooling, which, of course, he had never seen.
Well, now, this is back in 1843, and then, as I understand it, he's set to work with some of the industrialists and leading politicians to try to enact a law.
Well, Peabody was the first one. The use of children in the industrial phase of America's history was critical. It was essential. And Peabody was a very large railroad magnet, and also he owned a number of coal mines. So the railroads and the coal mines, they worked in tandem. The major force of coal miners in the United States, I know this will strike some of your listeners as bizarre, but it was small children, because the tunnels, the coal-bearing tunnels, were so small that 8 and 9 year old children, boys and girls, were the ideal people to crawl into them and hack away with their little picks. Quickly, this set of economic interests realized that what they would have to do to keep their future secure was to draw the children out of the entire community and habit and attitude train them in schooling, and Prussia was the only working model.
So in 1852, Massachusetts adopted the compulsory education law, and you're right, the rest of the states followed eventually.
Well, but the eventually is the key word there. New York followed immediately. Washington, D.C. followed immediately, and that's it. 15 years passed. No one else followed. How did the break come where one by one the other states fell in line? Well, the key is that Washington, D.C. was on board, and as we know now, Washington has the ability to print as much money as it needs to lay bribes around for compliant states. So we didn't get the last state in line until 1918.
Well, there was considerable opposition to the notion of compulsory education.
There was an enormous opposition to it. In Massachusetts, at one juncture, children were marched to school at Bayonet Point. I mean, what was recognized at first is that productive human beings had to become unproductive. Kids whose successful lives were based on making multiple connections in the society were disconnected not only from opportunity, but from their own families, their own traditions, their own religions.
Yeah, you quote Elwood Cubberley, the dean of a Stanford School of Education, and he wrote, quote, "Each year the child is coming to belong more and more to the state and less to the parent." That was in 1909 in Conceptions of Education.
Yeah, Cubberley said in his doctoral thesis at University of Columbia that the new type of schooling would shape and fashion the young like nails, so that, you know, they could be used in any industrial application. But he became the head of a national shadow organization called the Cleveland Conference. You can read about this in a very intellectual textbook called Managers of Virtue. The author is David Tyack, T-Y-A-C-K, and Cubberley took charge, once again, hold on to your hat, of every major administrative job in the United States, north, south, east, and west. And his shadowy Cleveland Conference would select, coming up through the ranks, those people willing to play ball with the new system of compulsory schooling that was intended to be the right arm, the strong right arm of government and corporate America.
How does it relate to the famous book Principles of Scientific Management by Frederick W. Taylor, published in 1911?
This idea that people were predictable machine parts was brought into industry by Frederick Taylor, who was a Prussian-trained social engineer. He invented what still exists called time and motion study. You must reduce the components of a system to a mathematically predictable conformity. So this became one of the major goals of the new institutional schooling. Now, parents weren't told this. You know, the bells just started to ring every 43 minutes. The standardized tests, which were intended to standardize, they have nothing to do with quality at all. I mean, it's a misapprehension to think the words high standards and standardizations are related to one another.
This came from Hugo Munsterberg from
Munsterberg at Harvard. But this was an international movement that eventually the United States took command of because we were so successful. I think the great irony is that our success was based on a kind of endless ingenuity, and this kind of a system destroys ingenuity. But because of the legacy of past generations, we still were immensely ingenious. So you only have to look at the steep drop in the number of patents attributed to Americans to realize what these decades of forced schooling have done to us. We've dropped from 90% of the world's total in 1939 to about 27% today, and the curve is steeply inclined downward.
You talked about the important role that John D. Rockefeller and Andrew Carnegie played in the evolution of the new system. One of the ways you point out is through founding places like Teachers College at Columbia, where they trained the future presidents of teacher colleges.
Well, not only Teachers College. I can give you Teachers College, Johns Hopkins, Yale University, University of Wisconsin, Stanford on the West Coast. All of these schools brought the German system to the United States. And because they had a great deal of prestige because the kind of families they recruited for their student body. Other universities were really heavily influenced to follow suit. But Carnegie was not content to rely on the force of example. He and Rockefeller joined together in the early part of the 20th century and created a private organization called the General Education Board. And the General Education Board offered for the first time pensions to college teachers, but only if the college would adopt the Carnegie credit system, which was this rigid apportioning of so many hours spent with language, so many hours spent with number. I mean, it still exists, although it's somewhat weaker than it once was. So that in a short time, every place in the country, high schools couldn't get their kids in college unless they followed the Carnegie system. But even the majority of private schools assumed that this had been scientifically arrived at. It wasn't at all. It was based on a sophisticated understanding of how a small group can impose its will on a large group.
And this really ties in with the principles of secondary education by Alexander Inglis, which is make people more manageable.
Inglis was big time as you get, and as a consequence, nobody who thinks they know something about modern schooling has ever heard of Inglis. When Inglis gets to Harvard, Harvard names its honor lecture in education after Alexander Inglis, and it's still in existence and still called the Inglis Lecture. Inglis was also the head of Houghton Mifflin's secondary school publishing division, and by the way, the head of their elementary school publishing division was Elwood P. Coverley. So that was the major textbook producer back in the 1920s. And Inglis laid down in a book called Principles of Secondary Education the actual functions that schooling had to serve. I'll just throw a few of them out. One was you had to make everybody, whether so-called gifted and talented or a dummy, absolutely predictable, because business depended on being able to predict what color in fashion the ladies would wear that fall, etc., etc. And therefore, you had to rig the game by making people predictable, by getting rid of their independent opinion.
The idea of ranking people and dividing them by age, which was completely different from the Ben Franklin system, was something really important in the principles of secondary education.
We're talking Julius Caesar here. What Caesar's Gallic Wars is about is how a small group of people can divide and conquer a large group of people by setting them against one another in petty competitions. That's what school structure is about. There's an infinite number of ways you make winners and losers and the mediocre.
How does that make it useful then to business?
Because it makes managers in charge of the only thing that matters to underlings. A pat on the back, an extra dollar in the paycheck, an office on the shady side of the building. It makes management semi-godlike, because your inner life is destroyed. You live to climb on the backs of who should be your natural allies. You've been divided from them. You've been divided from your family, divided from your religion, divided from your culture, divided from anyone who isn't exactly your same age or reading score in a standardized examination. You don't recover from that.
What are the implications of that system on how effective a democracy functions?
If people who are natural allies associate with one another and exercise their political franchise, they can in fact take over the system. So how can you seem to maintain a democratic structure, but in fact poison it at the root? Well, simply by dividing people against one another and putting them in constant competition with one another, it works to allow management to have its cake. Hey, we're a democracy, and eat it too.
Well, Congress did make findings which were very critical of big business control over education in 1913 and again in 1954 with the Reese Committee. Did anything come of these reports?
Nothing. The Walsh Committee and the other one was the Reese, The Reese Commission, and it found the same things that Walsh did, that the policy of schools is decided inside of about 12 private corporate foundations like Rockefeller or Carnegie or these days Gates. And inside these foundations, decisions are made about what school kids will study and how many will be tracked into the corporate world and how many into the industrial, and so on and so on. Both these congressional investigations made those same discoveries, and nothing else happened except school enlarged its reach, its depth, the amount of money it removes from the purchasing power of the public for operation. Every time we've increased the amount of money we give schools, they get worse. If you say to yourself, wherever you are listening to this program, that everything I think I know about schooling is not true, everything I know about school is wrong, you'll be much better off than saying, well, I understand how this works.
Well, do you think it's a feasible or practical to end compulsory schooling?
You can end it from the bottom up, because what ordinary parents think of as an education, in fact, can be mastered, can be taken on your own the way Ben Franklin did it, and Franklin's friends did it.
Thank you very much for that fascinating discussion and being with us today on History Counts.
Well, this is a pleasure.
Well, this is History Counts. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe, and we've been talking with John Taylor Gatto, the author and educator, about the history of American education. His website, again, is johntaylorgatto.com. Welcome back to History Counts. This is your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. One of the most outspoken opponents of the Prussian system of compulsory schooling was the 19th century New England intellectual Orestes Brownson, and he wrote the following, quote, "To entrust government with the power of determining the education which our children receive is entrusting our servant with the power of the master." History Counts is produced by MDR Productions, Inc., B.J. McDermott Rowe, Technical Director. Please visit us at historycounts.org, where you can listen for free to an archive of our programs, see a schedule of upcoming shows, and sign up for our monthly newsletter. Until next time, this is Ken McDermott Rowe for History Counts.